This is the After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
There it is. I have to add myself. Good afternoon. It is the After Party Live. So used to having Albert, then I have to come over here by myself, and all of a sudden it falls apart. Hey, everybody. Thanks for hanging on the Mark Thompson Show and here on the After Party Live. And again, huge shout out to Lori for sending me the legal as F link yesterday, which led to Karen. She's awesome. And I hope to have her back on the Mark Thompson Show. And again, really excited to have Brian Copeland on the Mark Thompson Show tomorrow as well as David Katz. So it should be some good times on the Mark Thompson Show. Please click the like button if you haven't already. Really appreciate if you could do that. And slowly but surely, building up the subscriber numbers on this show. We're not quite at 2,000 yet, but you know, a couple every day, it seems to be the way it goes. So if you haven't subscribed to this show yet, please do so. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Both of those things are free and so appreciated. Of course, there is a PayPal account associated with that this show, and you will find it in the show description. We are still demonetized as we switch over accounts here on YouTube. I think they take you down for 32 days. So we're still in the middle of all that. So at this point, the PayPal account is how we're making it work here on the After Party Live. But huge thanks to all of the folks who have taken the time to do this. So appreciate all of you. You are why this show carries on every afternoon. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy spending the time with all of you, and thank you for helping me make it work. So a huge After Party aloha to all of you. All right, let's jump into the show because there's a problem. At a couple of small South Bay airports, apparently rodents are causing issues. So not only are the rodents, I guess, causing damage to the runways at these airports, with rodents come predators like birds of prey. That's a problem when you have airplanes coming in and out of this area. So there's a double whammy going on here. This is a smaller Bay Area airports in the South Bay, specifically Reed Hillview Airport and San Martin Airport. And it's ground squirrels causing the problems, impacting possibly the airfield itself, the pavement, the signage, and the lighting in this area, basically chewing through wires and causing all kinds of damage to the runways. And then, again, the birds of prey are coming to munch on them, and that leads them to be in the same airspace as all these planes that are coming and going. So the ground squirrels have apparently been here for years, and we're talking hundreds, if not thousands of them. So pilots say as you're taxiing out of Reed Hillview or San Martin, they're running across the runways. And then the vultures fly really low. Pilots say, I've had close encounters with them. It can be like hitting a bowling ball in a general aviation aircraft. Extremely dangerous. And that is a big concern. The FAA flagging pavement maintenance, weeds encroaching onto runways, needed improvements to airfield markings and signs in this area. They've got to do better when you're talking about safety of planes coming in and out. And these are busy little airports, the Reed Hillview and the San Martin as well. I had to land in San Martin once when there was something wrong with a plane. And I was doing traffic for KGO. We had to set it down in San Martin and try to find our way back to San Francisco without a plane. That was interesting. Okay, let's dig into animals here. The first story I have for you involves a video. And this, I thought was, they do it better than I could ever do it. So we'll go right to it because apparently a puppy, a golden retriever puppy like I have, Charlotte's around here somewhere, gave birth to a litter of puppies, and one of them is a really, really interesting color. So let's check it out. This is a golden retriever who gave birth to a lime green puppy.
Going viral after being born a key lime color. And why not? Of all places, it could happen right here in Florida, of course, the Key Lime State. Take a good look at the screen here. Gold Retriever puppy. Her owner says the pup was stained in the womb by green biopigment. Sounds gross, but it generated a pretty color. It's a rare but not unheard of occurrence, we're told, that can result in the temporary coloring. Now more than 6 weeks old, the doggy, apparently named Shamrock, how appropriate, is back to her normal color.
Yeah, we just saw that video with the arrow. Yeah, you couldn't even tell the difference now. Right?
Oh my gosh, look at the stark difference there, but, though.
Yeah, back when it was just...
I would love to have a lime green dog as an adult.
I thought you were going to say baby.
Well, no, that's something else.
How cool is that? Lime green little pup. And temporary, but still kind of a cool phenomenon. All right, how about talking about this? We've heard, of course, of snakes on the plane. How about, gators stopping a plane? Look at him. He's under the wheels. This... really set everybody back because they had to leave it alone, leave it there. This alligator wandered onto an Air Force base, 10-foot-long alligator. This happened in Florida. It parked itself right on the runway under the wheels of this plane at MacDill Air Force Base in Hillsborough County in Florida. The gator making its way onto the runway and then crawling right between the wheels. You can see it there, right between the wheels of this plane's landing gear. They called out the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. They had to catch that gator and relocate the gator to the nearby Hillsborough River. They said, our newest toothy airman has been relocated to a more suitable environment off base. They think that he was pushed away from home. They had a alligator, I guess, named Elvis that had been spotted on the base numerous other times. So they said they thought Elvis may have pushed this guy out. So, all right. How about horses running amok in London? You see the picture. They're not going slow. They're not out for a Sunday trot. Something spooked them and they went running, and I mean fast, through London. They are household cavalry horses that apparently caused mayhem after bolting through central London. Unfortunately, one of the animals, you can see the white on the white horse there, was bloodied. I don't know if they understand what happened exactly, but they were taking part in a routine exercise, a military type of exercise in the Belgravia area. 7 horses and 6 household cavalry soldiers were participating in this exercise when chaos erupted. It seems that they were spooked by builders who were dropping rubble from quite some height right next to them. And that spooked the horses. They took off running. They threw 4 service personnel off. 5 horses got loose. 2 of them were filmed galloping through the streets of London. And again, you can see the white horse with blood on its chest. It hit a taxi. That's why it's a little bloody. Another animal smashed the windscreen of a parked tour bus. Eventually, these horses were captured by police 5 miles from where they ran off. But there's all kinds of video from taxi cabs and dashboard cams of these horses just running, like whatever it was scared them so badly that they're running into things and they're running through traffic. Really, really scary. 4 people were taken to the hospital from 3 incidents on Buckingham Palace Road, Belgrave Square, and the junction of Chancery Lane and Fleet Street, according to the London Ambulance Service. So it looks like everybody's going to be okay. Eerie, though. Kind of scary in that area. I have another story for you. And I'll just quickly mention these things because I know this is not what most of us... hopefully, this is not what most of us are drinking right now. But interesting enough that what we don't need are giant vats of sugar to drink, yet that's what we're getting. McDonald's restaurants are cutting the pricing of their drinks for the summer. They're cutting the prices on all frozen and fountain drinks. Now through September 2nd, you can get, I guess, any size soft drinks. From the small all the way up to the gallon load size for $1.49. I guess that's quite a reduction because they don't say exactly what they used to be, but I think it's in the $2 to $3 range now for a drink at some fast food restaurants. The fountain drinks, all the Coca-Cola products, the frozen Fanta, blue raspberry, the Hawaiian Punch, frozen coffee drinks from the McCafe menu are not included. And I guess people are excited about this. I don't know. Something else drink related, the introduction of some new Pepsi flavors. Also not necessarily what we needed, but yeah, this is Pepsi introducing two new flavors, which they think will go along very well with summer barbecues. Lime Pepsi and peach Pepsi. Did we need this? I don't know if we needed this. And I don't, it sounds, peach Pepsi sounds kind of gross. Maybe. I'm not a big sugary, I don't drink sugary drinks anymore, but maybe for people that like Pepsi. Pepsi says, the peach provides a delectable, sweet, refreshing flavor to enhance the bold, dynamic, smoky, savory flavors created on your summer grill. Huh. I don't know. They're also now releasing grilling tips so you can have your summer Pepsi along with your barbecue. Let's talk about this story. This is so interesting. We're going to go from sugary drinks to space. Unprecedented images are revealing these images of Jupiter's, they call it a tortured moon. It's called Io. Io. It's one of Jupiter's moons. It's the most volcanically active world in our solar system. And there's a lava lake and a towering feature called a steeple mountain on Io's surface. Io is a moon of Jupiter. They know this because NASA's Juno spacecraft, which first arrived to study Jupiter and its moons in 2016, flew within 930 miles of the lava world's surface in December and February to capture what they say is the first detailed images of Io's northern latitudes. Been more than 20 years since a mission went so close there. The spacecraft's camera is called JunoCam. So JunoCam captures high-res images showcasing active volcanic plumes, mountain peaks, a glass-smooth lake of cooling lava, which I think is what you're seeing here. Io is simply littered with volcanoes, according to Juno's principal investigator at the Southwest Research Institute. And he says, we caught some of them in action. They say we also caught great close-ups and other data on a 127-mile-long lava lake called Loki Patera. There's amazing detail showing these crazy islands embedded right in the middle of potentially magma lake rimmed with hot lava. I have video. Let's take a look at it. I mean, it's pretty cool. See if I can play the video for you. Here you go. Check it out. Video provided by NASA and JPL. And there's the islands in the middle of this cooling lava lake. Pretty incredible. The spectacular reflection of our instruments recorded of the lake suggests parts of Io's surface are as smooth as glass and reminiscent of volcanically created obsidian glass on Earth. Really, really cool images. So, look at that. I mean, yeah. So, those are renderings, but pretty cool. I mean, you imagine when these images come back, what they're looking at and what they're thinking. Right? The new data, they say, is painting a more clear portrait of Io. It's something that has really interested scientists for centuries. Other than Earth, it's the only place where we see active magma volcanoes going on in our solar system. So they took portions of Juno's data and they put it into animations, which we just watched, bringing some of the surface features of this world, like Loki Patera and Steeple Mountain, into dramatic focus. Why were they able to film this or take pictures of this? The help of the sun shining on Io's surface. That's what created the shadows that reveal the very sharp peaks. And they use the scientific data to understand the shadows and measure the distance. They said they might not have it perfectly right, but it's sort of what it would be like if you went there. So interesting. The temperatures of the magma on Io amount to thousands of degrees. The surface of that moon likely minus 148 degrees Fahrenheit, though. So they say when the magma comes out as a volcano goes off, it immediately freezes and then probably makes sulfur snow. That's all the white stuff you're seeing. Love that. How about from that to a little yoga at the Louvre? Hey, why not? It's something they're doing, of course, in France, to gear up for the Paris Olympics. They're hosting yoga classes during the Paris Olympics for everybody who's coming to Paris to see the events. And they're planning to organize yoga and sports sessions inside the galleries as part of a citywide cultural program ahead of the Olympics. So they're offering visitors the chance to take part in dance, yoga, and workout sessions with instructors and coaches while you look at world-renowned paintings and sculptures. So instead of going to the gym, watching the TV while you work out, you go to the Louvre and you look at the art while you work out. This is one of several announcements made to whip up support and enthusiasm ahead of the start of the Olympic Games in Paris on July 26th. The Louvre is physically in the center of Paris, according to the museum chief. It will be physically at the center of the Olympic Games. So, the opening ceremony is going to take place on the river running right past the Louvre. They've got a temporary stadium to host the skateboarding and the breakdancing being built at the nearby Place de la Concorde. The Olympic flame is set to burn in the neighboring gardens. Four other art destinations, the Musée d'Orsay is one of them. They will be also put on Olympic-related sports or cultural activities for people that are in the area as well. They've got 26 fan zones they're creating around the capital, in addition to two special celebration areas where medal winners will be encouraged to greet the public. For the first time, they say, in the history of the Olympic Games, the host city is aiming to create a people's games where Olympic enthusiasm can be shared both the event sites but also outside the stadiums in the heart of the city in each different district. They have a new Olympic Transport mobile phone app as well that the Regional Transport Authority is behind. And people are encouraged to use it to get around. Well, it'll be interesting. I had a friend who just went to Paris and came back a couple weeks ago. And she and I went to Paris. It was like the only time I'd ever been to Europe. And we went together. And we were at the Eiffel Tower by the river. And it was beautiful and clean. And she went back a couple weeks ago. And she said, now it looks like San Francisco, and there's homeless people up and down the river. So I don't know what Paris is going to do. They're going to have to do some cleaning up before the Olympics, right? Kind of like what San Francisco did when the recent summit was held there, how they kind of shuffled people out of the way and then put up these big fences so that when you were inside of the event, there wasn't any of the riffraff. Yeah. We'll see how it works out in Paris. I don't know. Let's, how about this? The lotto story of the day. It's not an After Party Live without a lotto story of the day, is it? This is funny because this lady that won is completely oblivious. I have to admit, this might be something that I do. This happened in Oregon. This person bought a raffle ticket, a lottery ticket, Oregon lottery raffle ticket, they call it, worth $1 million. And she put it in a Tupperware container with all of her other lottery tickets right before the Powerball jackpot. So I guess in Oregon, they call it the lottery raffle, but it was a Powerball. So she puts it in the Tupperware and she's 52. She told the Oregon lottery officials she brought the stack of tickets from her Tupperware container to the local Fred Meyer in Happy Valley after she heard on the news that a recent Powerball jackpot someone had won and that she had several unchecked tickets. So she thought, better check them. The very last ticket coming out of the Tupperware container for the March 15th raffle caused the machine to display a message Carr didn't understand. So she asked the clerk for help and I heard him say, "Oh, I can't cash this because your prize is worth over $1,000. She said, "That's when I started getting the butterflies." The ticket she bought from that same Fred Meyer was a $1 million winner. She said, "I had no idea I was a winner. If it weren't for the $1 billion Powerball winner making news, I would have completely forgotten. We don't check our tickets," she said. "Why don't you check your tickets? What's the point of playing if you don't check the tickets?" Come on. She said it's a dream come true. Her plans include paying off her mortgage, buying a new truck, and taking a vacation to Hawaii. I think you could do all that with $1 million. Sure, why not? More power to her. How about we go back to space, the final frontier? This story is Voyager 1 has come back online. Finally, after 5 months of repairs, sending readable status updates. It's a deep space probe named Voyager 1. And it, along with its twin, Voyager 2, they're the only spacecraft to ever fly interstellar space. And they haven't been able to send readable data about how the Voyager is doing or about the scientific mission since mid-November. But after very sophisticated, they say, attempts to establish a tech workaround, NASA is saying its engineers succeeded, and now they are once again receiving engineering status updates that can be deciphered from Voyager 1. But it's hard to read them, and so they're really having to work hard on this. The problem traced to one of the onboard computers aboard Voyager 1, called the Flight Data Subsystem, which is responsible for packing the science and engineering data before it's sent back to Earth. It's a single chip that's malfunctioning. So they fixed it up, and it looks like things are working. They're still making some changes on that and some upgrades on that, but it looks like they've got it going again. Okay, I almost didn't want to play this for you because of the noise, so just be aware that this might be a little bit loud. But this boy, I think he's about 9 years old, has won this contest. It's a screeching contest. He's dressed up as a seagull, and you won't believe the sound that comes out of this kid's mouth. It's pretty crazy. Here it is. I warned you about the noise, right? Vancouver. Yeah, pretty good. I mean, that's, yeah, there he is. It sounds a lot like a seagull. All right, I'll stop, I promise. It sounds a lot like a seagull, right? That's pretty good. So he's the screeching winner. He's 9 years old. The contest held in Europe. And he's from Derbyshire, England. His name is Cooper Wallace. They call him Seagull Boy. He wore the full, as you saw there, full seagull outfit. And he showed off his skills in Belgium at the European Championship Gull Screeching event. He said he took up the art of seagull screeching after he was nipped by a seagull when he took a trip to the beach. He said, I wanted to remember the noise, to remember I got pecked by one. But he said, I actually like seagulls. He said he has a deep respect for them, and his imitation is more a tribute than a mockery. So he said, I feel like they're a really nice animal. I like them because of the noise they make. Sometimes, he said, they can be a little bit scary. And he says he's still a little bit wary of eating at the beach. So it's why he eats in a small tent now when he goes to the beach. But that's good. The judges analyze every contestant by criteria, including the calls, the competitor's seagull garb, and their ability to emulate seabird behavior, which he showed off by pecking at his sister's French fries. He scored a total of 92 points out of 100 and won in the juvenile category, earning the most points of any competitor in any age range at the entire event. He said, my school friends thought it was annoying at first, but now I did it. So there it is. That it is a little annoying, but also kind of cool. Wanted to do something, went out in the world and made it happen. All right, how about we go back to space for a minute? Have you heard about this? The solar sail. This is a New Zealand rocket lab which has launched this NASA solar sail. So I've been watching this story and I knew they were going to do it. And it looks like they've done it with success. The rocket lab launched NASA's new composite solar sail into space, where it will now undergo weeks of testing using sunlight to propel it through the solar system. The solar sail technology lifted off aboard Rocket Lab's Electron. They had it alongside the South Korean payload NeonSat-1. It was a ride share to space called the Beginning of the Swarm. It launched from Pad B in New Zealand on Wednesday. They had a bit of a ground system issue, so it was a little bit of a delay, but it made it up there. And there it is. So they're going to be testing this. And it's interesting to see it up there like that. Speaking of things going into space, what goes up sometimes has to come back down. And so the FAA is now going to require a re-entry permit, a re-entry license, I should say, to prevent spacecraft from getting stuck up there. So you need a license to come back to Earth, apparently. This story out of Popular Science says, what happens if you design a spacecraft to survive re-entry, but launch without a green light from regulators to bring it back down? Well, that happened with Varda Space Industries. They fired a capsule into orbit last spring to make stuff in zero gravity. Well, it turns out you might have to park up there in orbit until your FAA paperwork is ready to go. A new April 17th notice, effective immediately, the FAA indicating it's looking to avoid repeats of what happened with Varda, which successfully landed its capsule in Utah after about a 7-month delay. They were trying to grow ritonavir crystals in space and taking advantage of the environment to improve the efficacy of the HIV antiviral drug there. They didn't, the FAA, cite that incident directly, but they say they're not going to be allowing re-entry vehicles to launch without a license to return. So if you plan to bring whatever you've launched up there back, you can't send it into space in the first place unless the FAA has preemptively deemed that your re-entry plans are safe. Otherwise, don't even try it. The FAA says it analyzes the impact vehicles may have on public health, property, and national security before issuing re-entry licenses. So without approval, pre-approval, the FAA says critical systems could fail, or the vehicle might run out of propellant or power before regulators and reentry operators get all their ducks in a row. They've reviewed numerous details that are self-disclosed by reentry operators, including the payload's weight, the amount of hazardous materials it has on board, the explosive potential of payload materials, and the planned reentry site. I think this is a great idea. I mean, don't you think somebody should be paying attention to where these things are coming back down and whether there's any danger to people on the ground? With the whole Varda situation, they say they got launch approval last year, that they complied with all regulatory requirements, that they did learn some lessons, though, the FAA said, when they approved the company to launch without a reentry license. So the thinking is that as spaceflight evolves, they're going to have to pay more attention to returning vehicles, right? Trying to avoid collisions with people and property on the ground. Unlike typical payloads designed to operate in outer space, a reentry vehicle has primary components designed to withstand reentry substantially intact, right? To come back pretty much intact. So you have a near guaranteed ground impact. So they've got to get a hold of what's going on there. Maybe there are companies that are like, oh, now we have to, they're going to want money for a reentry license and they're going to want this and that. I'm thinking, thank you. I don't know if you saw this story, a little celebrity news. I can imagine that it would get really, really frustrating to be constantly asked about it, hounded about it, and whatnot. But this isn't a regular hounding. This is Alec Baldwin caught on camera swatting a woman's phone out of her hand after she confronted him about what happened not only on the film set of the movie Rust, where one of the cinematographers was shot and killed because there was a live bullet in the what was supposed to be a blank, right, in the gun, but also about his stance on Israel and Palestine. So this happened Monday at a cafe in New York City. They have video of this, but it's not a real journalist. This is a person who's known as a provocateur. It's an American performance artist, and they call her an ambush interviewer who goes by the name of Crackhead Barney. So right away, it's not legit. Crackhead Barney goes, confronts Alec Baldwin at this cafe, and asks him, why did you kill that lady? You killed that lady and you didn't get jail time. No jail time, Alec. No jail time, Alec. So you can see this is confrontational. This is meant to provoke a response, right? I would think if you're a celebrity of this much stature, a well-known type, right, where you have probably lots of money in the bank, that you do a better job of keeping your cool, because you know when you go out in public, there are going to be people like this that are going to ambush you. There are going to be things like this that happen. But I can, no matter what, understand getting frustrated. And he did. And he swatted that phone right out of her hand as she's, you know, bombarding him with all these questions. I think it's kind of it's not a physical attack, but it's definitely a mental attack on someone. So employees at the cafe escort Crackhead Barney out of the coffee shop, but she's still yelling and hollering on her way out the door. She says, just one time, answer just one time and I'll leave you alone. Just say Free Palestine one time. He tells her to get out. He holds the door open. He shakes his head. She continues going on and on and on and on and on. And toward the end of this video clip, Alec Baldwin is seen asking someone to do him a favor when he snatches the phone out of Crackhead Barney's hand. So she says he attacked her while getting coffee. But that's not necessarily the whole story, is it? They say the person filming this video was not trying to get coffee. They repeatedly and viciously harassed Alec Baldwin and refused to leave the establishment when asked to do so by the staff. There's also no evidence they were attacked. I guess the day after that, crackhead Barney posted that they should call for a truce and go get coffee. People are nuts. Nuts. And that's what you have to deal with when you have this celebrity type of status. Speaking of celebrity status, now I've never heard of her, but apparently this woman is quite a famous fashion designer. Her name is Nancy Gonzalez, and she's 71. And I guess she's made these bags, handbags, out of animal skins, like crocodile and snake skin, and didn't have the proper permits to bring them in for U.S. fashion shows, so smuggled them in. Can't do that. She's admitting to recruiting couriers to carry as many as four of her products on commercial flights from her native Colombia to the United States for New York Fashion Week and other high-profile events. She was arrested in 2022 here in California. In Cali, in her native country, Colombia, Cali, Colombia. And then later extradited to the United States. And this week, for breaking U.S. wildlife laws and smuggling in these purses made from the hides of caiman and pythons bred in captivity, she gets 18 months. 18 months for doing that. She's crying. She's feeling bad. She's saying, from the bottom of my heart, I apologize to the United States of America. I never intended to offend a country to which I owe immense gratitude. Under pressure, I made poor decisions. So they say she didn't get the proper permits from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is all part of the international treaty governing the trade of endangered and threatened species. That animal skins are worth a lot. The animals, the caimans and the pythons bred in captivity, were worth as much as $2 million. The designer's lawyers said each skin only cost around $140. So I don't know. Gross. Who wants to carry a real alligator skin purse? I would feel so bad carrying that around. Even snake skin. I know a lot of people have snake skin shoes or snake skin purses. No thanks. No. How about the evolution of bioluminescence? I'm fascinated by bioluminescence. I don't know about you guys, but Popular Science has this article about how it may have evolved. And they think that it might have happened 300 million years earlier than scientists previously thought. You see bioluminescence in jellyfish, sea creatures, right? Plankton, all kinds of marine invertebrates. And an international team of scientists found bioluminescence may have first evolved in a group of marine invertebrates called octocorals at least 540 million years ago. So that's about 300 million years earlier than they previously believed. And with this new information, it could help explain the origin story of bioluminescence. And nobody knows why it first evolved in animals, but maybe they can help figure it out. And it's not just sea animals. We've got it, fireflies, glowworms, even some species of fungi, mushrooms on land, right? Well, now they're looking back into the evolutionary history of octocoral to search for clues on when it first appeared in the animals, the bioluminescence. So interesting. The figuring out of the timing of the origin of bioluminescence and octocorals, one of the oldest groups of animals on the planet known to bioluminescence. The question is, when did they develop this ability? And then why did they develop this ability? So there trying to create this evolutionary tree of octocorals and evolutionary relationships using the data from 185 different octocoral species and looking at fossils and physical features and trying to figure this all out. So maybe we'll have some more information on bioluminescence. I'm interested. Do you see this daddy long legs robot? I love this biomimicry where they look at the movement of a creature and they think that could work on the moon, right? What if we designed a robot that moved that way, that could scale rocks and hang upside down and do all of these things? So it's a spider bot. They call him, it's a daddy long legs inspired robot. They hope one day could be creeping through Martian caves. The spider bot's extendable legs can grasp onto uneven rock surfaces and propel it forward. So interesting. This comes from researchers at Stanford. They are citing the Harvestman spider, also known as Daddy Longlegs, as inspiration for this new robot design. They think it could be better equipped at navigating uneven rocky caverns and lava tubes. And one day, if they get it right, they hope it could help robots navigate the icy caverns of the moon and Mars. This is called ReachBot, is what the name of it is. ReachBot. You can read more information about it if you'd like in the journal Science Robotics. It has multiple extendable boom limbs, which it can use to reach out for rocks and then propel itself forward. Each limb comes attached with a three-finger gripper that grabs onto the rocks and uses them as anchor points. The long-legged design, like the daddy long legs, means the robot's limbs can potentially access the floor, the ceiling, the walls of a lava tube or cave, and give it a little more leverage to move around in there. It lets ReachBot assume a wide variety of possible configurations, bracing stances, and force application options. It's a gap that exists, it seems, among robots meant to explore. Small robots, useful for navigating through tight corridors, often have limited reach. But the larger ones might be able to reach more, but they're too heavy and they get weighed down, right? So this ReachBot is a compromise by relying on a small main body with limbs that can expand and reach out if necessary. Got a bunch of onboard sensors to scale the area, looking for concave rocks or other signs of suggestive of a graspable area. So I think this is all really cool, but for some reason, why in my mind am I seeing those the robots that come after the characters on the Matrix, right? Where they're smart, they can move around, they can see you, they can sense you. They're making these things too smart. I don't know. But it could help us discover things. So I'm all for that. Can we talk about this science of sleeping birds? How pretty that little bird is. This is a great kiskadee is the name of this bird. And researchers studied great kiskadees. They're small, brightly colored flycatchers that live in South America, Central America, Mexico, parts of Texas as well. And they wanted to look at these birds because they're looking at the vocal muscles in their chests and throats that move even when they sleep and make noise even when they sleep. Kind of like the way if you're, I don't know if cats do this, cat owners chime in, but you know how if you have a dog, when the dog falls asleep, it kind of squeaks and shakes sometimes when it's having a doggy dream. Well, they think maybe birds do the same thing. I don't know if cats do this, but for the first time, researchers have translated birds' sleeping muscle activity into sound. This is all laid out in the journal Chaos, And the hope is that it offers new insight into the avian brain, as well as what birds might dream about when they're asleep. Oh, Gordon says cats twitch when they dream. Yeah? Interesting. Heather says, yeah, kitties do that too. Cool. Yeah, it is a pretty bird, isn't it? So do birds dream? And what do birds dream of? I mean, it's a question I don't think I ever would have even thought to ask myself. And maybe that's why I think it's so interesting, right? So they set up this experiment involving a couple of great Kiskadees, and they captured them. They surgically implanted electrodes to record the muscle activity while they were sleeping and while they were awake. And they recorded about 100 instances of muscle activity associated with singing. And then they created a model to predict which types of muscle activity produced which sounds. Then they used the model to bring the bird's silent sleeping songs to life. And one of the synthetic songs they produced matched the noises Kiskadees make when they're flying over territory. And so they went back and they looked at video footage of the sleeping bird from that moment, and they noticed its head feathers were standing on end, just like they would be if the bird had been awake and sparring with a competitor. And so the study's author, a biophysicist at the University of Buenos Aires, thinks it's possible the bird was having a bad dream. You could figure it out, he said, that this guy was experiencing a nightmare, probably recreating the whole experience of having a fight in his sleep. Now, can they prove it? Not yet. But even if birds don't dream the same way that humans do, being self-aware with language, that type of thing, the findings suggest something is going on inside the minds of sleeping non-human creatures. Whatever could it be? Yeah. All right. I want to talk about, before we go, this story about a really creepy find. I don't think I'll ever go to a home goods store again. And you're right, Teacher Lori. Why do we need to know about this enough to torture animals? I hope that the birds were okay. They say they were okay in the study. It seems like a lot of stress to capture them and implant these, you know, electrodes to get the collect the information. It's interesting to know that other animals dream, but I would agree with your assessment there. So again, this is a very, very creepy find. Check out what this dentist found in the floor of his parents' home. It's a jawbone with teeth. Mm-hmm. This dentist spots something in a floor tile that looks a little too familiar to him in his parents' recently renovated house in Europe. He's a dentist, right? So he knows what a jawbone and what teeth look like. So he goes up and takes a closer look, and he says it appears to be part of a human jawbone, and it still had teeth. It's embedded in a hallway leading to the home's terrace. A mandible appears to have been cut at an angle. He said it reminded him of a CT scan he sees at work. What? He says, I specialize in implant dentistry. So I work with these kinds of images every day. And I looked at the floor and it looks awfully familiar. He didn't want to give his full name, because he's trying to protect his parents' privacy. But he found this jawbone in a travertine tile. A travertine is a type of limestone that forms near hot springs. This particular travertine came from a quarry in western Turkey. And it was excavated there. It formed, between 0.7 and 1.8 million years ago. So they don't think it's a mandible from somebody who died recently. Travertine forms when a change in chemical conditions cause dissolved calcium carbonate to harden into solid rock. And usually when it hardens, it does so in layers. And that's what makes travertine distinctive and visually appealing with all these different layers and, you know, textures to it. But the layers can trap anything that falls into them, like leaves, feathers, dead animals, apparently even a human. Until recently, the jawbone discovery, they say, is somewhere between uncommon and common. That doesn't say much, does it? This geologist at the University of South Carolina says it's not a crazy thing to have happen. Anywhere you find travertine tile, you might also find fossils. Right now, everyone's like, oh, I have travertine tile. Let me go look. The travertine-clad Getty Center in Los Angeles has a treasure trove of fossils. There's feathers in there, old algae, bacteria, even an animal foot, and some leaves. Since this dentist has posted about his discovery, he's been contacted by researchers. They want to come take this tile out and study it. And they're also now talking to the company that sold the family the tile so that they can look into the remains and other pieces of travertine that came out of that same quarry. So just by looking at this photo, experts say they can't really tell how old this jawbone is or even which species, modern human, early human relative, they're not sure who it belonged to. They want to run it through a CT scanner, construct a 3D model, do some chemical analysis of the rock to figure out exactly how old it is, maybe take some samples of the tooth enamel to hold clues over of what the jawbone's owner ate, take a little DNA and test this thing out. The photo, though, they say has one interesting clue. The person may have had some dental work done. And by dental work, kind of rudimentary. So forensic dental consultants say there appear to be absent teeth and the bone tissue has filled in to where the teeth once were. So another human potentially intervened and removed teeth due to injury or disease. Maybe the teeth got knocked out or fell out. How do we know? There have been all kinds of fossils found in travertine. Deer, mammoth, reptiles. There was a case where there was another set of human remains. It was fragments of a human skull cap that showed signs of tuberculosis. That was about 1 million years old. It was the first Homo erectus ever found in Turkey. So the question is, when they're at the travertine tile factory, why didn't anybody notice the jawbone at any point before or during the installation? So the people at the travertine factory didn't notice. The people that packed it didn't notice. The people that installed it didn't notice, right? Apparently, quarry workers make rough cuts of travertine. While doing so, they check for big defects and gaps before they begin polishing the stone. Then they stack it for shipping. The defects and inclusions are the reason people want the travertine in the first place, so they don't really merit special attention. The consumers who buy travertine usually browse samples in a showroom to choose the type of rock, and they don't see the actual panels until they get it installed. So, according to this study, they say the next time you renovate your home, if you're putting in travertine tile, really inspect these tiles. Or if you want the fossils and maybe you want to increase your chances, maybe just don't look. Just throw it on in there and see what happens. Fascinating. I kind of like what a story to have a million-year-old jawbone in your hallway leading to your patio. Lastly, this tortured poets department album released by Taylor Swift, I swear, all she has to do is say one thing and all of a sudden everybody wants it, right? In this case, one of the songs on her new album is now causing a resurgence in old-fashioned typewriters. All she did was mention it in one of her songs, she sings about a breakup with her boyfriend who comes to retrieve his typewriter from her apartment. And that's it. Since the song came out, people with that are still there out there that sell typewriters, fix typewriters, sell typewriter equipment are getting a steady stream of calls. This one man runs this store in Texas called Lazy Dog Typewriters. He said since the song came out, people are calling and calling. Most people inherited a typewriter from a grandparent, and they want to fix it up so they can use it now. And he says, yep, the ribbon is still available. So you can still get the ribbon. You can still use a typewriter. So interesting. I don't have a typewriter anymore. I gave it away. My mom has one, I think, though. So interesting how she says one thing in a song, one song lyric, and boom, everybody wants a typewriter again. I don't know. Well, thank you for being here for the After Party Live. I appreciate you so much for hanging out. Liz still has one in storage. Right on. Nice. Thank you for being here. Please click like. Please click subscribe. If you can do me this favor and check out the YouTube channel and share one of the shorts that I've produced in the last couple of days, that may help us grow the show as well, which is something we need to do to keep it on going. So again, thank you to everyone contributing to the PayPal account. Thank you to everyone who is participating in the chat and who gathers, congregates every day here in the After Party Live chat. You are very much appreciated. Let me take Taylor down. Hi, you are very much appreciated. Just so you know, I love y'all. Okay, tomorrow, again, Nikki Maduro show, 10 a.m. bite-sized chunk. I hope you've been enjoying those. I know they're shorter. We're trying to keep the chat open for longer, and hopefully that's working out. But we always would love to hear from you on whether or not you think it's working or how we can change it. And Nikki actually has a survey about the changes in the show and what you'd like to see there. Mark Thompson show, 11 a.m. Hal Rudnick will co-host with me. So really excited about that. Brian Copeland on the show. David Katz on the show as well. Former federal prosecutor. So we'll do that. And then we're back to the After Party Live. So I hope you'll join me for that again. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your kind of chilly afternoon here around the Bay Area and make it a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.